his forehead wrinkles ruefully. I suppose it gives me slightly more insight into supervillain psychology than most officers have. On top of the Crim Psych degree. So you think you'd be a good fit to lead Transhuman Policy Coordination superhero team? He shakes his head. Not lead, exactly, no. But once you've staffed it, you're going to need a big stick to keep the egos in line. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that, he points at my violin case with his spoon, is more of a sawn-off shotgun than a sidearm baton. You need someone who can handle the police procedural aspect of the operation, but who your team know isn't just a paper pusher. You make a cogent case. I make a show of checking my watch, then drain my mug. Listen, I'm due in another meeting in half an hour, and I'm running late, but I really want to take this further. Do you have a card? He nods, and we do the business card swapping thing. Great. Got to run. See you later. And I'm out of there before he can work his way any further into my confidences. He's smooth. Wow, is he smooth. He's almost too good to be true. And I did not get this job by taking anything at face value. Even straight arrow superheroes in police uniforms. Memo to self. As soon as I get a chance to check my email, send a request for information up the line. Because if you've been lying to me, Officer Friendly, you are so screwed. Picture the scene. Later that evening. It's 9 o'clock at night in the O'Brien Howard household. Currently reduced to just me, my violin, and my husband's cat. I got home a couple of hours ago, showered, changed into jeans and a sweater to remind myself I wasn't working and am supposed to decompress while off duty, and made myself a lonely supper for one. M&S, pre-packaged salad. Ugh. And the remains of a chicken I've been working on. I started to tackle the washing up, and I'm about to perform triage on the fridge contents. It's astonishing how quickly food goes off when you downsize your family by 50%, when my mobile trills for attention. I grab it with soapy hands and nearly drop it when I see it's Mary calling. Yes? I demand, tensing in anticipation of bad news. Boss, we just got a code blue. The landline from work rings. Hang on. I tell her, and dash into the front hall to grab the ancient Bakelite handset. O'Brien here, D.O. Is this a code blue for my team? I have the unique pleasure of hearing surprise in the duty officer's voice. Yes, Doctor. I have an all-hands call-out for the Transhuman Policy Coordination Team, incident on Euston Road. Please hold, I tell him. To the phone in my other hand. Mary? Are you getting this? Euston? Yes, I'm on my way out the door. Okay, I'll meet you there. Notify the analysts, I'll handle the DO. She hangs up, and I focus on one thing at a time. Sit rep, please. Freudstein just hit the British Library. It takes me 22 minutes to get to Euston Road. Most of them spent trying not to throw up all over the floor of a police car whose driver is in a real hurry. My mobile is ringing almost constantly throughout the trip, adding to my nausea with a constant diet of dismaying information. This time, Freudstein didn't make it in and out before we got the news. There's still a chance he's on the scene, so every second counts. Mary is on her way. And so are about half of SCO-19, the Specialist Firearms Command. Everybody is very excited and keyed up, which is exactly what we don't need right now, because it's the perfect recipe for a blue-on-blue clusterfuck. My driver screeches to a halt at one end of a pile-up of patrol cars, dog vans, and firearms units that stretches halfway from Euston to St. Pancras. Sirens, and the strobing of many light bars turn the night to hell. It's raining lightly, and a pall of smoke hangs on the air. I bail out, look around for the nearest body, who looks as if they're directing traffic. The cops are sending the buses and taxis that normally clog this stretch of road linking three of London's biggest railway terminals on a magical mystery tour to keep them out of stray bullet range, and walk towards him, holding up my warrant card.
Stop right there, miss. Don't move.
The constable who gets in my face this time is much less friendly than the ones in Trafalgar Square, even before you get to the semi-automatic carbine he's carrying, a submachine gun by any other name. I freeze, but raise my voice, keeping the card where he can see it.
O'Brien, Transhuman Policy Coordination Security Service. Responding to control request for specialist backup, take me to... Stand down!
The stentorian roar seems to come from about a meter above and behind my left ear.
Stand down!
I can't help myself. I jump halfway out of my skin as I turn and look. You've seen TV news broadcasts and newspaper reports, and maybe even thinly fictionalized movies, but nothing can prepare you for your first superhero. Officer Friendly looms behind me, silhouetted against the red brick wall surrounding the library campus by the flickering light bars of vans and fire engines, one of which I now see is wedged in the crumpled and bent steel vehicle gates opening onto the piazza, stopping them from closing. He hovers a meter above the street, and I can see a faint shimmering beneath the ridged soles of his steel boots. His suit is blue, somewhere between cobalt and dull gunmetal in shade. A thing of interlocking slabs of metal that is more like a deep-sea diver's hard shell or a space suit than medieval armour. There's an elaborate equipment belt, of course, and a Tetra radio handset incongruously clipped to his left pauldron, screen glowing pale grey. His face is a steel glacis pierced by narrow dark vision slots beneath an armoured copy of the regular policeman's custodian helmet. The light beacon on top pulses lazily, flaring blue against the night.
Dr. O'Brien, this way please.
Officer Friendly descends from the sky and steps onto the pavement with a ponderous thud, boots clomping like the armoured treads of a main battle tank. The firearms officer takes a step back and waves me past, then starts speaking into his radio headset.
Is Freudstein still inside the building?
I ask, hurrying beside him. Officer Friendly appears to move at a slow walk, but it's only slow if you're not trying to keep up. Jim cranks his megaphone down to a merely human volume level, for my ears only.
We don't know. SCO-19 have secured the perimeter and evacuated the admin block. Two security guards are unaccounted for.
Is it on fire? We reach the stretch of curb that fronts the library's huge air conditioning outlet gratings, now silent.
We don't know.
A group of armed officers are crouched behind the rear of the fire engine.
Freudstein's minions hit the fire station up the street. They TDA'd two pumps at gunpoint just as a visitor in the library tripped the fire alarm. When the library gate guard saw fire engines with lights, he opened the gate, at which point pump number one drove in and ram-raided the library shopfront window. They rammed the other pump into the gate to block it.
The gate opens into a piazza with sculptures, benches, a fountain, and the usual service access entrances. Viewed from the ground level on the outside, the library is a windowless slab of red brick that sprawls across almost as much land as King's Cross or St. Pancras stations.
The first responding officer attempted to gain entry, but retreated when shots were fired. Since then, there's been no sign of anyone leaving, so we've got a potential hostage situation with the missing guards, not to mention the contents of the library.
I shudder. Losing the library would be a catastrophe. The British Library is the second largest research library in the world, with over 150 million items in its catalogue, and about 200 kilometres of shelves occupied by everything from a copy of every newspaper and book published in the UK to originals of the Magna Carta, the Codex Sinaiticus, and several collections of priceless ancient manuscripts.
You're sure it's Freudstein?
If he's here, he's probably after something important. Officer Friendly reached into an armoured pocket on one giant thigh and produces an evidence baggie. There's a familiar-looking business card in it.
Found balanced on the steering wheel of the pump wedged in the gate.
Well, that tears it. So far, Freudstein's existence isn't public knowledge. But that's not going to last. It suggests we're dealing with someone who's hungry for fame. We're level with the huddle of armed officers near the entrance. A couple of higher-ups are approaching on foot, winkled out of their offices in Scotland Yard by what promises to be the major incident of the decade. I see another familiar figure approaching. She's with me. I point at Mary, and a minute later she's with us, standing in the lee of the pump, looking like either an upwardly mobile plainclothes detective inspector or an out-of-place banker.
Officer Friendly, this is my deputy director, Mary Murphy.
Mary, this is Officer Friendly. I gather as a chief superintendent, he's the ranking officer here. Mary ducks her head, and I see that sometime after I left the office, she scrubbed off the layered war paint she uses as sunblock. She looks younger without it, and almost colourless. There's a burst of radio chatter from the armed police, followed by some shifting around. One of them gets down and begins to worm his way under the crashed fire engine, pushing an assault rifle kitted out with night vision sights before him. Two others climb into the rear cab through the open door, then disappear from view.
What's going...
Wait here!
Officer Friendly says tersely. Then he gathers himself and jumps. I'm expecting him to come back down with a jaw-rattling thud, but he soars up and over the wall and the fire engine and vanishes from view. A couple of seconds later, there is indeed a loud thump as he lands on the far side of the obstacle. Then a succession of shouted orders as half a dozen specialist firearms officers pour through the open doors of the fire engine and into the piazza beyond it.
I hate this, Mary says vehemently. Who does he think we are?
I slide the violin's case around and rest my hand on the handle. Civilians who aren't equipped for a shootout.
Right.
Mary unfastens her jacket, and that's when I realise she's wearing a discreet shoulder holster. Standard issue Glock 17 by the look of it.
What are we waiting for again?
I flick the catch on Lecter's case and lift him out, then close the case and sling it over my shoulder. Mary tenses. Ever been part of a blue-on-blue incident? I ask. And she pauses momentarily before she shakes her head. Very tactful of her. Trust me. You don't want to be. Even more tactfully, I don't ask if she's been certificated to carry that pop gun. Anyway, it's not as if she needs it. I hear more radio chatter from the two cops who've remained behind. One of them turns to us, his face pale in the gloom.
Mom, the super says they've secured the piazza and established a security cordon inside the lobby and library shop. If you'd care to...
Mary doesn't wait. She jumps for the back of the wedged fire engine and scrambles up and over it terrifyingly fast. I swear quietly and take the low road through the back of the cab and over the seat backs and then slither down through the front door. I don't want to be silhouetted against the sky, and besides, I'm carrying. The smell of wood, or paper smoke, is much stronger inside the piazza, along with an acrid note that reminds me of bonfire night fireworks. My heart sinks. Whatever we find inside, it won't be good. The bad guys' black-clad minions have had half an hour to ram-raid a repository of the nation's most precious treasures and set fire to the rest by way of a diversion.
Police officers run past us and disperse to prearranged points close to the fire exits that open onto the piazza as we leg it towards the second fire engine, which is embedded in the shattered brick and plate glass front of the institution's bookshop.
How did they expect to escape?
Mary asks quietly, echoing my own thoughts. I don't... There's a crackle of automatic gunfire from the direction of the elevator tower that overlooks the piazza, followed rapidly by really loud return fire from the specialist under the fire engine, about 10 meters behind us.
Cover!
I shout, and Mary blurs into motion, vanishing into the shattered front of the library lobby, pistol in hand. I don't hang around either. If I could see the shooter, I could light him up with Lecter, but we're exposed on the piazza, and it's just turned into a killing ground, as witness the AFOs all scuttling for cover like heavily armed cockroaches. We make it into the darkened lobby and go to ground behind the receptionist's podium. The fire alarms are shrilling, and there's glass everywhere on the mosaic-inlaid floor. The central atrium of the library stretches up above us, but something is badly wrong. It takes me a second to realize that the 5-story-high display cabinet full of rare manuscripts is leaning sideways, ripped away from its upper floor supports and glass front smashed in an act of calculated vandalism.
They're still in here,
Mary says quietly, leaning close to me. Her nostrils flare. Her pupils are very wide, black holes in a paper-pale face. I shift my grip on Lecter. For a miracle, he's obedient, waiting on my command. He shows no sign of thirsting after my executive officer.
Yes, and in a moment, I'm going to locate them. Don't be alarmed.
I raise the violin, flick on the pickups, and finger the strings as I lean back and point the pegboard up into the darkness of the mezzanine level. Mary holds her breath and tenses, but doesn't flee.
Meanwhile,
where are they? I ask, opening myself to the feeling of fingers on my bony spine, an indescribable sensation.
Where are who?
My instrument sounds lazily amused.
Don't fuck with me, Lecter.
You know who I want. He doesn't reply, but shows me. Pale dots in the twilight, blue figures determinedly moving between cover as they push further into the building at ground level. Further away, carmine drops of glowing blood pierce the night like a vampire's kiss. They're down below, in the archival stores under the public spaces of the library.
Typical.
Officer friendly and his folks are storming the wrong floor. I open my eyes.
Follow me,
I tell Mary. She nods, pointing her gun at the floor, then follows as I crawl out from the desk and scuttle towards an unmarked door with no handle, an emergency exit from the staff-only spaces of the institution. It's secured by an electronic combination lock, but Lecter makes short work of it. Lecter barely gives me any warning at all when a group of cops converge on us from a side corridor. I get an inkling. Then a man's voice shouts,
"You! Stop right there!"
And suddenly, we're covered by the wobbly red dots of laser sights, like hungry bed bugs, only much less friendly. Mary hisses. I stop and turn just in time to see Mary raise her warrant card, glowing a nacreous silver in the darkness, as she bares her fangs at the nearest cop. The one who's talking, not the half-dozen others who are aiming.
Stand down! Stand down!
Who the fuck are you?
He demands.
Transhuman Policy Coordination,
Mary says crisply enough.
Security Service.
Get officer-friendly here, I add, raising my own warrant card. He's chasing the bad guys' decoy.
Their real target is down here in the stacks. Follow me, I'll take you to them, and you can do the forced entry. About 30 seconds later, we're on course for the emergency stairwell down to the second basement level. This time, with half a dozen AFOs in tow. Their eyes slightly glazed by the impact of two laundry warrant cards demanding their obedience. They're all dressed in their best stabbies and armed to the teeth with a librarian's nightmare of high-energy paper punches manufactured by Messrs. Heckler and Koch. I'd be a lot happier if I was at the head of a proper Oculus team from the territorial SAS, but needs must. They came here to steal a rare manuscript, I explain, showcasing my elite powers of deduction. And they're all over the controlled environment archive along... I stop. We're at a crossroads, facing a corridor. Most of the lights are out, except for the emergency exit illumination. But the doors to either side feature round portholes and warnings about halon discharge fire suppression systems. The basements are all climate and humidity controlled. I blink, and Lecter shows me a clump of rubies in the night, just beyond the next door. They're in here, I whisper to Mary, who nods, and relays the word back to our escort. I squint at the sign. Rare manuscript scores, 7612/A. Scores? Musical scores? I turn back to the cops. You have three targets in this room, I tell them. One, about 3 meters to your left, as you go through the door. Two others among the shelves 5 meters over to your right, and about 10 meters away, near the back of the room. I'm about to step back and hand over the forced entry to the cops, if necessary dragging Mary with me because, let's face it, neither of us are trained or equipped for close-quarter arrests. Too much risk of us accidentally killing someone. When the door flips open, and everything goes to shit. There is a bang so loud that it's more like having my head slammed in a door than anything I can call a noise. There is also a blinding flash of light. I fall over, clutching Lecter as I go down. And a couple of pairs of size 50 hobnail boots run past my shoulder. Through the cotton wool haze in my head, I hear shouting, a piercing scream, and the flat bang of pistol fire. Stop! Police! You're under arrest! Booms a voice the size of an aircraft carrier. Oh, great, I think dazedly. Officer Friendly saves the day. For my part, I'm trying to stay out of the way because I'm on the ground and I'll get myself damaged if I get in the way of the ruck that's just thundered past me into the document store. A hand grabs my shoulder. Dr. O'Brien, are you all right? I open my eyes and see Mary leaning over me. She looks extremely pissed off. Maybe 30 seconds have passed, but it feels like an hour. Flash bang? I ask haltingly. My ears are ringing, and purple-green after-images dance in front of my eyes. Yes. She stands, then grabs me by one hand and hauls me onto my feet. I manage to lean against the wall as I unwrap myself from around Lecter. I'll have new bruises tomorrow, but I kept him safe. You're late, she says coldly to somebody standing out of view behind my shoulder. I use the seconds to try and pull myself together. You shouldn't be here. Officer Friendly dials his voice back down to normal. There are shooters at large. Yes. Well, I force myself to stand on my own feet, albeit unsteadily. What they came for is in here. How do you... The blank metal face turns to me. No. I raise Lecter. Come on if you think you're hard enough. The violin taunts him silently. I don't give voice to the words. Jim, we're from the laundry. It's our job to know. because we're an intelligence agency, and how much intelligence do you need to figure out that if a mad scientist sends their minions to rob a library, they're more likely to be going after a rare manuscript than last month's issue of Homes and Gardens. The shouting and banging has moved away. Lecter shows me a cluster of dots, dimming as they disappear down another corridor that opens onto the far side of this archive room because, silly me, of course you'd design more than one exit onto a conservation store full of priceless and potentially combustible manuscripts. And if you think the police are coming in through the front, you throw a flashbang at them by way of distraction before you leg it out through the back. They're getting away, I add.
I don't see how,
Officer Friendly says tersely, then clams up, obviously sucked into another round of radio comms with his colleagues.
Oh, follow me at the double. It's kicking off upstairs again.
He doesn't wait, but pounds away back the way we came, like a baby tyrannosaur in cast-iron clogs. Mary and I trail along in his stompy wake, followed by a forlorn gaggle of officers who couldn't keep up with the escaping furball as Freudstein's minions beat a fighting retreat from the archives. As we arrive in the lobby, a deafeningly loud helicopter roars overhead, so low that it almost scrapes the steeply pitched upper roof and elevator tower of the museum. It's big and fast, and as it circles to hover over the flat roof of the Centre for Conservation, tiny figures scramble through the windows overlooking the flat deck and rush towards it. Shit. I shouldn't swear in front of employees, but right now I find I don't care about setting a good example. Besides, everybody else is thinking it.
The roof won't take it,
Mary exclaims excitedly. It's almost as if she wants to see a disaster. I don't think they're planning on staying for a picnic, I tell her. Officer Friendly dashes through the lobby and lifts off like a rocket, then circles around the helicopter. But for some reason, he keeps his distance. A moment later, I hear more gunfire and flinch. They're shooting at Jim. For some reason, this makes me much angrier than the flashbang earlier or the unaimed fire when the police gained entrance. Almost as angry as the desecration of the national institution we're approaching. The smell of smoke is strong. We keep well back behind the police line, but the awning over the building blocks off our view of the drama unfolding on the rooftop as the pitch of the helicopter's engine winds up. Where are they? I ask Lecter.
They? You mean your prey?
He still sounds mildly amused. Yes, them. He shows me. Pale red dots now, visible through the glassy outline of the walls, as they scramble roofwards.
Mine,
he says eagerly. Not yours.
Not them, fool. What they took.
Wait.
What?
I clamp down on it. Some questions are best not asked in the presence of the pale violin. Whatever Freudstein wanted, he's got. I'll learn what's missing tomorrow, when Lecter is safely back in his box and the staff have had time to comb through the wreckage. I hold the violin at the ready, braced against my shoulder, and line up on the rooftop. Then I shiver in the grip of an adrenaline-driven cold sweat as I realise that I could take down the chopper. But then what? Decisions. At least 6 heavily armed bad guys just stole a national treasure and they're getting away.
I can take them,
Lecter tells me, chillingly assured. Yes, but then the chopper would crash. And I have this vision of 4 or 5 tons of metal and jet fuel raining down on the National Library of Records' rare document collection of the deaths of everybody on board, at least 6 people, and possibly of officers on the ground, and the loss of whatever they stole besides. It just doesn't bear thinking about. I can't force the chopper down and resolve the situation safely. All Agent Candid can do is destroy everybody on board and escalate a clusterfuck into a catastrophe. Stand down. I shakily force myself to lower Lecter, then unsling the violin case and re-inter him. He buzzes his frustration in the key of a million flies as I latch the lid. Then I watch from the shadows of the broken building frontage as the chopper hovers over the rooftop and the robbers climb aboard. I've got a bad feeling about this whole situation. It stinks. Jim might be able to track the chopper. More likely it's a job for air traffic control, and an RAF fighter will already be inbound to intercept it. But if this is Freudstein, we're talking about the criminal mastermind who robbed the Bank of England. He'll have contingency plans in hand. He'll have anticipated the prompt dispatch of a pair of typhoons, and if I gambled, I'd bet serious money that by the time they scream in from the QRA line at RAF Coningsby in Lincolnshire, which is 10 minutes away, because they're unable to go supersonic on full afterburner without breaking half the windows in North London, the helicopter will be nowhere to be found. The chopper turns and thunders away, the pounding of its blades setting up a matching echo in my skull, which is still aching from the flashbang and the mental exertion of keeping Lecter from going on a killing spree. Once it's out of sight, I shuffle back into the atrium to look at the gigantic display cabinet and the other cases where documents of national significance are laid before the public. The lighting in here is dim, even in daytime, to avoid damaging the delicate treasures stored under glass in humidity-controlled cabinets. The main display may be badly damaged, but the cabinet on the mezzanine landing is intact, and I take a shuddering breath of relief as I look at one of the two surviving copies of the Magna Carta on public view, the 800-year-old foundational document of our system of government. Someone clears the throat. I glance sideways. It's Mary. "Look," she says, pointing, with a finger that I am gratified to see is wobbling just a little. I'm not the only one who's outside her comfort zone tonight. Then I follow her direction, and my stomach clenches. The glass is intact, and the precious manuscript is undamaged. But, positioned proudly on top of it like a brash intrusion from another era, is another of Freudstein's calling cards. He's thumbing his nose at us now. Look what I could have taken if I'd wanted it. This is going to be a very long night. Chapter 8. Unavoidable Consequences. The next morning I head for the office early, still yawning. I was up past midnight being checked out by paramedics, then filling out incident reports, then pull my emergency meeting suit out of its carrier and head round to the new annex. I've been summoned by the auditors. Happy joy. It's not just the SA, in his capacity as chair of the incorrigible committee, but the auditors as a committee, sitting en banc. The report on Agent Candid's encounter with Stripjack Spratt has collided with a copy of the fatal accident report that is climbing its way up the Independent Police Complaints Commission's entry and butted heads with yesterday's fracas at the library. We still don't have a complete list of what went stolen or missing in the raid. Freudstein's people made a comprehensive mess out of the main display in the atrium and did a real number on several archives, and were working over the rare music manuscripts when I interrupted them. But the auditors want to hear from me in person, even in the absence of a full report. This is quite worrying, because it suggests the organisation as a whole may be going into damage control mode. They've cleared one of the larger offices on the top floor, one of the mahogany row offices, and rolled out the resonant carpet. I wait in the receptionist's office until I'm summoned, trying not to succumb to anticipatory collywobbles. I've been so busy lately that this almost seemed like a trivial irritation at first, certainly after being carpeted by the Cobra subcommittee and then the Home Secretary. I'm becoming inured to high-level grilling. But you can't ignore the auditors. They are the front line of our operational oversight system. If you run an organization that gives people like me extraordinary, and lethal, occult powers, you need investigators with similar skills to keep them on the straight and narrow, and their powers to compel and control are themselves extraordinary, and potentially lethal.
Dr. O'Brien, if you'd please come in.
The secretary to the audit committee sticks her head round the door and gives me a sympathetic smile. I stand up and enter. There are five of them, sitting behind a table with seating for six. The empty chair is telling. Judith, I think with a pang.
Good morning,
says Dr. Armstrong. His colleagues nod affably.
Hello,
I say, somewhat nervously.
If you'd like to take a seat,
ask the man to the SA's right. His accent has a faintly musical lilt, not one I recognize. He's a distinguished-looking fellow in late middle age, possibly with Jamaican ancestry. His beard is bushy and mostly white. There's a wooden chair in the middle of the grid, woven into the carpet. Thanks. I walk across to it and sit down. My buttocks tense, as if I'm taking a seat in Old Sparky.
Let's keep this simple, shall we?
Ask the woman sitting to the left of Judith's empty chair. Middle-aged, mousy and inoffensive. She's probably capable of zapping me into a pile of smouldering cinders if she takes a dislike to me.
Dr. O'Brien.
She looks at me, and as I meet her gaze and fall into her infinitely dark pupils, I lose contact with my body.
Did you deliberately kill Strip Jack Spratt, also known as Dougal Slaythwaite, in the cells under Belgravia Police Station last Thursday?
No.
My tongue is chokingly large and made of dry leather, dusty as the tomb. I can no more stop it wagging than I can stop my heart beating. I was unaware of the significance of his medical condition until it was too late. My interrogator nods. The SA looks relaxed as he asks the next question.
Do you believe he was working for Professor Freudstein?
That seems probable, although I believe Mr. Slaythwaite might not have fully understood what he was doing. The auditors glance at each other.
Told you so,
murmurs the man on the SA's right. More questions follow, as they piece together a detailed timeline of the events in Trafalgar Square. Then, probe my awareness of the unpleasantness at the Bank of England, and finally, walk me through my recollection of yesterday's events at the British Library. Then,
do you have any other suspicions?
Asks Dr. Armstrong.
Maybe.
My traitor tongue is hesitant? In front of the auditors? I nearly go cross-eyed in disbelief, despite the powerful gesh that alienates me from control of my own body.
What do you mean, maybe?
The woman sitting at the far right end of the table leans forward intently. She's nearly as striking as Mary, but entirely human. She has long black hair, and is somewhat Middle Eastern-looking, seemingly younger than I am, although you can never be certain among the DSSs of Mahogany Row.
What do you...
Wait, Seth, says the other woman. Let her...
I somehow manage to lick my dry lips.
I'm not sure, and I don't want to prejudice your investigations, suspicions not related to the killing, no obvious causal chain, but there's something odd about the staff assignments to the Transhuman Policy Coordination Unit. Something smells funny.
Dr. Armstrong smiles.
Good, he says. If you'll excuse me, He turns to his colleagues. We have addressed the core concern, have we not? If you don't mind, I would like to discuss Dr. O'Brien's other concerns with her under her own volition, rather than under compulsion in my capacity as operational oversight supervisor for the incorrigible committee.
Why don't you want us to...
Seth seems to want to grill me further, but the SE won't let her. He turns positively waspish, in fact. You know perfectly well that once you start digging for information under compulsion, trying to find evidence to support a hypothesis, you will find it every time. Even if it's the wrong hypothesis in the first place. I would prefer to rely on Dr. O'Brien's freely given cooperation. His smile vanishes. Why don't you, Persephone? Don't you trust her? She crosses her arms.
Very well. Have it your own way.
She's obviously annoyed with him about something, but I have no idea what, and it's perilously far above my pay grade to speculate. Chalk it up to hitherto unexplained politics among the auditors, throw salt over your shoulder, and move on.
End testimony.
Incants the mousy-looking woman. Directly to me.
You may leave the grid now, Dr. O'Brien.
I feel as if invisible fetters have just evaporated from my hands and feet. I take a deep breath as I stand up.
Thank you.
Don't thank us.
She nods affably.
Your oath of office simply verified that you cleared yourself.
The SE stands up and walks across the room. He holds the door open for me. I emerge blinking into the daylight, feeling shaky and a little numb. More formerly solid pieces of my life are crumbling into fragments. Everything is spinning out of control. It's not a sensation I am remotely at ease with. After my session with the audit committee, I take a long lunch break while I pull myself together. I then head over to a police station to give a statement about last night's excitement, then back to the office to chip away at the paperwork mountain. And I'm still there at 7 o'clock in the evening when my desk phone rings.
You've got to come home, says Bob. Spooky needs you.
But I don't need Spooky. It's 7 o'clock, and everyone but me and Mary have gone home. I told them all not to bother coming in before noon tomorrow unless they feel like it. They're still catching their breath from the weekend madness, and I'm playing catch-up from the weekend, the home office grilling, and an exciting visit to the library. It feels as if I'm drowning in work, but it can't wait. Right now, I'm paging through a list of rare music manuscripts that are missing from a certain archive, trying to figure out if there's anything here that might give us a handle on Freudstein's goals or interests. Bob sounds distressed.
They're sending me away tomorrow.
What? Does not compute. Suddenly I find myself paying complete attention to the phone call. What do you mean?
I have to go up to Dunwich.
Angleton ran a lab there for dangerous experiments of some kind, and they need me to defuse the defensive wards. It might be an overnight trip, but... having seen what he did to his office, it could easily take me the rest of the week. Work can wait.
Where are you now? I ask. In the kitchen.
Oh, damn. This long-distance telephone tag is no good, I tell him. I hit save on the laptop, leaving the list of stolen manuscripts for later. Judging by what his minions took, Freudstein must really like obscure 19th-century violin pieces. How about I come round? Do you want to call for a carry-out? Hope begins to rise. I know you're scared of the violin, but I figured out a way to secure it overnight.
Let's do that, he says after a pause.
Make a formal date of it.
A date? In my own home, with my own husband? How strange.
Something about his offer makes me shiver, but in a nice way.
Yes, let's do that.
Love you, he says, as if he needs reassurance.
Love you too, dear. I'll be about an hour.
It takes me 10 minutes to prepare my suitcase, grab my violin, and lock up the office. Mary looks up as I pass her open door.
What's up?
She asks. I show her some teeth.
I've got a home to go to.
See you tomorrow.
She wrinkles her nose. Don't you want to see the list of what Freudstein grabbed?
She looks affronted.
I pulled in favours to get this report, Mo.
Oh, wait. Is that the same list I got 3 hours ago because of...
Nope.
She turns her laptop so that the screen points my way.
This is what Officer Friendly sent round 15 minutes ago. They eliminated duplicates and struck off a lot of items that got thrown on the floor when Freudstein went through. And we're down to about 50 possible primary targets and maybe 200 other items. But...
She flashes me a feral grin.
I asked the archivists at Danzy House to cross-reference them against our classification index.
Oh. Good thinking, I admit. I lean Lecter's case in the doorway and cross over to her desk. She can probably hear my heart thumping involuntarily, but she gives no sign of it as she pointedly turns back to her computer. Did they find anything?
Not much, she admits. But there's a lot of weird-ass shit. That's their term, by the way, not mine. In the BL stacks. And some of it is possibly interesting. Did you know they had the score to a rock opera composed by Charles Manson on file?
Her brow wrinkles.
It's a bit shit, she admits. But that's not all. A whole bunch of esotericists dabbled in musicology over the past couple of centuries. Freudstein stole an organ piece by Aleister Crowley to be performed in Coventry Cathedral, the old one before it got bombed during the war, during a thunderstorm to summon the great salamander of galvanism, whatever that means. Bloody show off. Then there's Delia Derbyshire Symphony for fixed disk storage systems that requires about £2 million worth of 1970 vintage IBM 370 series mainframe. Apparently if you move the disk drive, read write heads fast enough, they make screeching sounds at set frequencies. And there was an operetta of The King in Yellow, scored as a violin concerto. It's all rare stuff, but it's hard to put a cash value on it. It's not like the Bank of England heist. Maybe Freudstein's trying to steal the soundtrack to a low-budget horror movie.
I sigh. What kind of sense do any of Freudstein's activities make? We've got a no-shit mad scientist on our hands and no idea what on earth he's trying to achieve. In terms of profiling him or her, we're a complete bust right now.
You done good, I assure her. But I really have to be going. Domestic emergency.
Bob wants the cat tray cleaned.
Can you email it to me for tomorrow?
I mean, unless there's something so time-critical that it really can't wait for morning.
Sure.
She sounds slightly disappointed.
No, nothing that can't wait. Probably.
She pushes her own chair back.
I could be going too,
she says quietly, as if trying to convince herself. Knowing we've at least got a handle on the extent of the robbery salves the pain very slightly, which I need because the long hours have finally gotten to me. The adrenaline surge from my grilling by the auditors has long since worn off, and I feel, not to put it too crudely, like a used dish rag. I catch a bus most of the way home, then walk the last half kilometre. The suitcase seems to gain an extra kilo with every step. By the time I get to the front door, I'm almost staggering. So I lean close enough to push the doorbell with my nose and wait. Seconds pass. Then the door suddenly opens and I fall into the welcome arms of my husband.
Mo.
I drop my suitcase.
Ouch.
It lands on his foot.
Sorry,
I murmur in his ear. I have a double armful of husband. World's best teddy bear / security blanket, combining intimacy and sex. What was I thinking, letting go of him? Oh, right. The violin case I'm holding behind his back suddenly weighs a ton. I reluctantly relax my grip on him. Let me in. I've got stuff to put down.
Food can be ready whenever you want, he says,
taking a step back. He looks me up and down with evident concern. Whether for my well-being or because he's worried I'm about to explode isn't immediately obvious.
Come in, Mo. Make yourself...
A sad little chuckle.
At home.
I step across the threshold, shove the door closed and look at him. Same old Bob. Maybe beginning to go a little thin on top. Are those new worry lines etched around his eyes? He's wearing the Hugo Boss suit I made him buy for meetings, albeit tieless, which is ultra-formal in Bob terms. I am acutely aware that I look like I've been dragged through a hedge backwards. Will dinner keep? Because I want to hit the bathroom first. I've been living out of a suitcase for days.
That makes two of us, he says. Don't worry about the food. I can heat it up.
Now he looks obscurely disappointed. You look great. Which is a little white lie. Bob never looks unreservedly great unless I put some effort into his turnout. But I want to build bridges, not burn them. And he seems to want to make an effort. The past week has been the cinematic trailer for Divorce, the high-budget remake. And it's not a movie I plan on buying a ticket to. I don't even want it on cut-price DVD, thanks. I put the violin case down, then close in on my man for a hug and a kiss. I was hoping for something more than a peck on his sandpaper cheek. Disappointment stabs briefly. Sore at me?
A little, he admits.
I make a second attempt, and we smooch like awkward teenagers for a few seconds. Not only is it unsatisfying, one or both of us has morning breath. I pull back. I really need the bathroom, I say. Freshen up in a quick change. Then I've got a surprise for you, if you're still serious about us dating. Half an hour? He thinks for a moment, then nods.
I'll feed Spooky and lay the table. She likes to sleep on a full stomach.
He looks at me, and I shiver pleasantly and raise an eyebrow, and he twitches back, and suddenly I know we're on converging courses again. We've been together long enough that we can read each other's signals. Deferred gratification, I warn him, then grab my suitcase and violin and flee upstairs. How do you prepare for a date when you're worried you've irreparably damaged your marriage? I shove my violin case in the wardrobe again, lock it, and check the ward I put there last week is still working. Then, I make sure the damn cat isn't hiding in the bedroom, strip off and head for the shower. It's not actually as good as the one at the office. We have no booster pump at home, just traditional British plumbing that predates the last ice age. But it's mine. In my own home. That makes up for all defects. Also, I've got a shower cap, which shaves half an hour off the process. I raid the bedroom closet for my special underwear, then slither into the other dress I bought for the diplomatic junket and didn't get to wear. It's not so much cocktail hour as black tie. A black silk number that I knew at the time was a bit too daring, but couldn't resist. Floor-length skirt slit as high as my stocking tops. Lace bodice with short sleeves. At the back of the shoe rail, I have a pair of 5-inch heels I shouldn't have bought in the first place. So high I can't descend a staircase in them without a handrail. Then I add lipstick and eyeliner. This is silly, I think. It's bedroom cosplay. I wouldn't dare wear this combination in public. But in my own house, with my own husband, who isn't terribly good at doing subtle.
How's the food, dear? I call down the stairs.
Are you hungry?
He replies from below. In the living room, I think.
Because I can have it ready in 15 minutes.
He'd better not. I have other plans.
I'll be right with you.
I manage to descend the stairs safely, then mince into the living room and strike a pose. Bob is sitting on the sofa with a half-empty glass of red wine in one hand, reading something on his tablet and looking morose. I notice he's actually wearing a tie, a piece of fabric to which he's just about allergic. For Bob, this is more than smart. He's making a weddings and funeral grade effort. I'm touched. The moment lasts almost a second, then he notices me. He drops the tablet and puts the wine glass down and stands up hastily, looking dazzled.
Do you like this?
I ask.
I.
He licks his lips.
Wow. You said you wanted a date. I didn't think you meant a night at the opera.
I didn't. His pupils dilate. I look into his eyes and see my own need mirrored there. I step close to him and take hold of the end of his tie. I tug. Gently.
Come here, husband.
He makes an unfamiliar growling noise and zombie shuffles closer. Then remembers to wrap his arms around me and pull me close. My bedroom-only heels are so high that I'm actually looking down into his upturned, wondering face. My great big teddy bear doesn't do subtle. You have to tell him what you need very clearly. It's not the opera, dear. I just want you to fuck my brains out. God, I've missed that side of things.
What? Right now?
I silence him with a kiss and reach for his fly. His brain might be stuck at deer in the headlights, but below the belt, he's getting the message. He kisses me back with increasing urgency, finally realizing that I'm serious and he's not hallucinating. I crouch down and open his fly and lick, then suck, until the taste of his skin fills my mouth and I can feel his fingers tangling in my hair and he begins to make a noise like a stovetop kettle's whistle.
Oh, God, Mo,
he moans, and I shiver. I give him a last kiss and stand up.
Do me,
I tell him,
right now.
He picks me up and carries me to the over-padded sofa where he lays me down, carefully parts my legs with his hands and sets fire to me with his tongue. I close my eyes and fantasize my faceless dream lover in his place and I begin to shudder. Then, when he's sure I'm as desperate as he is, he climbs on top of me and we mate like frenzied 40-year-old mammals who know it might be their last time ever. We make it to the kitchen eventually, in my case by way of a diversion to the bathroom to undo some of the worst of the damage. I confront myself in the mirror. My hair is back to being a nest fit for crows. My lipstick and eyeliner are smeared. One lace stocking is slightly laddered. I left my shoes and best knickers on the living room carpet. And my fortune cookie says there will be a big dry cleaning bill in my future. So why is my reflection glowing? Sounds carry much too well in this house. And I can hear Bob whistling as he putters about the kitchen. I ache pleasantly. And I'm hungry, and he's about to feed me. Life is suddenly more than good, it's wonderful. I fix what I can fix, bounce downstairs, and ease my feet back into my bedroom shoes because I want to serve notice on Bob that we aren't done yet. Then I tiptoe through into the kitchen, where pleasant smells are wafting from the fan-assisted oven.
Nearly ready.
He says cheerfully,
pulling back one of the kitchen chairs for me. He has actually unearthed the linen tablecloth, a wedding present that sees the light of day less than once a year.